This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
This is Positive Parenting, and I'm Armin Brott. Pregnancy is exciting and exhilarating, but it can also be physically and psychologically demanding. The myth that's perpetuated by social media says that you should be glowing, but in reality you may be anxious and you may find yourself on an emotional roller coaster, and that is okay. Feeling stressed and moody are very normal reactions to the changes your body's going through and the thoughts you might have about how the pregnancy will impact your career and relationships and the social pressure to have a perfect pregnancy. High levels of stress and anxiety are not good for you or your baby, but there are ways to cope with and counteract these feelings, to put them into perspective and to bring peace to your pregnancy. It is indeed possible to learn new skills that will enable you to glow, in reality, and to thrive. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with an expert in the field about how you can adjust your expectations, how you can restructure negative thought patterns, cultivate resilience, and not only meet the challenges of pregnancy, but happily anticipate the most amazing experience of your life, becoming a mother. I'm Armin Brott. We'll start talking about how to find calm and bring a little bit more of that to your pregnancy when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
Excuse me, do you know how to get to Maine and Maple?
How's that cook?
How do you change the ringtone?
How much does this cost?
Does this bus stop at Elm Street?
We ask questions everywhere in life, except...
Any questions?
No.
At the doctor's office, ask questions.
What is this test for?
Are there any side effects?
Questions lead to better health care. Go to ahrq.gov for a list of 10 questions everyone should know. Questions are the answer. Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. My guest for this part of today's show is Alice Domar, who's the author of Finding Calm for the Expectant Mom, Tools for Reducing Stress, Anxiety, and Mood Swings During Your Pregnancy. Alice, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So why is pregnancy such a stressful time when it's built up to be the most amazing time of your life?
You know, I think for some women, it truly is the most amazing time of their lives, and I think it's incredible for a woman to be able to bring a baby into the world. But I think, in fact, our society focuses mostly on the fact that it's the most amazing time in your life, and I think a lot of women are caught off guard by the emotional and physical symptoms which accompany most pregnancies.
Okay, and why don't you talk about what some of those are?
Well, you know, certainly women expect to have morning sickness, because everyone talks about morning sickness, and women may expect to need to pee all the time, which is sort of one of these things that go along with pregnancy. But I think there are a lot of other things that people don't expect. You know, it's not just morning sickness. A lot of women feel nauseous, you know, 24/7. They may not expect vomiting. They may not expect the leg cramps. They may not expect the back pain. And there are a lot of the physical symptoms, the sweating, the intolerance of hot and cold. I think it's the emotional symptoms which perhaps catch more women off guard, because you're supposed to be radiant, you're supposed to be glowing, this is supposed to be the happiest time in your life. A lot of women sleep very poorly during pregnancy, and so they're exhausted, which can make you feel tearful. And so I think women feel, you know, they feel guilty that they're not happy all the time. They might be frightened by their ambivalence about being pregnant. And so it can cause a lot of complications. And in addition to that, there are a number of women who were depressed or anxious before they got pregnant. They might have gone off their medications, and so they may have a recurrence of these symptoms while they're pregnant, and they feel very conflicted about whether or not to go back on their medication.
Well, I guess they would be concerned, rightfully so, about whether it's going to cross over the milk barrier and be a problem for breastfeeding, right?
Exactly. And so, in fact, I wrote a paper a couple years ago summarizing the risks for a woman of taking antidepressant medication, SSRIs, before and during pregnancy. And, you know, there are risks. There's no question. I think everyone agrees that there are some risks to taking these medications during pregnancy. for each woman, it's an individual decision. Because for some women, it's better to, you know, risk those risks because you don't want them, you know, not being able to get a bed because they're so depressed. You don't want them, you know, being suicidal. And it would be clearly far safer for her and her baby for her to take the medication during pregnancy.
Would you go so far to say that pregnancy itself is a risk factor for depression?
Absolutely, yes.
Wow. Okay.
People who have a history of depression often relapse during their pregnancy.
Because there's so many of these other things that are going on. I mean, we all know that, that sleep deprivation, or not even deprivation, just being really, really tired all the time.
Right. It's funny because one of my colleagues, Jody Mandel, published a paper maybe about a year ago where they actually surveyed women at all trimesters of pregnancy. And, in fact, throughout pregnancy, women have a really hard time sleeping. You know, either they have to go to the bathroom, or they're having heartburn, or they're having leg cramps, or the baby is doing what I call the 2 a.m. Olympic trials, where the baby's kicking a lot so you can't sleep. And when you're tired, being, you know, sleep deprived is a risk factor for depression, just an independent risk factor for anybody. So, in effect, pregnant women have a lot stacked against them.
I mean, I've written a lot about pregnancy from the father's perspective. And mm-hmm. every once in a while, I come up against this, which just sort of makes me wonder, why would anybody do this? I mean, well, I mean, obviously, it's for the perpetuation of the species, but it just seems like, you know, I mean, from a guy's perspective, you know, why would anybody have a second child?
Well, because they're so cute. I mean, I was just in my cousin's house, and I was holding a three-day-old baby, and I was thinking, wow, I wish I wasn't too old to have one. And they're really cute. And, you know, when you get through the pregnancy and have a baby, you know, being a parent for a lot of people is the best experience of their lives. So I do understand, and I think you also forget, you know, how tough a pregnancy can be, or you know, have these expectations that a second pregnancy is going to be easier than the first one because you know what to expect. But, you know, I feel like a lot of the reason I wrote the book was just to reassure women that all of these feelings they have and the symptoms they have are normal, and not to feel weird or lonely or guilty because they're having these feelings.
You know, you haven't even really touched on yet. I mean, you're talking about the physiological stuff, which by itself is enough of a problem. And then there are the societal burdens which are put on to pregnant women about don't drink, don't eat sushi, don't change the cat litter, you have to do this, you have to do that, if you watch the wrong movies. I mean, it's like, you know, it's not exactly the same as it was when the, what was that guy's name, John Merrick, the Elephant Man, that sort of thing, that, you know, if a pregnant woman saw some horrifying sight that would, her baby would be somehow disfigured.
Right,
we're not, we're not quite there. But it's still, if you have a lot of stress, you're going to do this. There's a lot of stuff that's just dumped on women who have no control over. Go ahead.
People feel like a pregnant woman is community property, and so, you know, they feel perfectly willing to walk up to a pregnant woman and touch her belly, or, you know, tell her she's too big or that she's carrying too small, or tell her what baby, you know, what gender baby she's going to have, or criticize her for the name she's chosen. And I have to say, I'm guilty of that. I was in the Caribbean last winter, and, you know, Zika was added, you know, huge fear about Zika, and there are pregnant women there. And I remember thinking, why would they have gone to the Caribbean when there's Zika here? So I think we all feel judgmental of pregnant women, and it's really not fair. It's her body, her baby.
And do you find that, you know, you have a lot more experience looking at this, that women actually are internalizing these things and feeling bad about them? Or are they able to say, screw this?
No, they feel bad. I just saw a patient of mine the other day who was about 30 weeks, and she's carrying small. She's very tall. And it makes sense that it's her first baby. She's carrying small. And her obstetrician says, this baby is growing totally normally. You're healthy. You've gained the exact right amount of weight. You're perfect. And every day someone comes up and says, oh, how far along are you? And that's, oh, my God, you're too small. You must not be eating enough. And it makes my patient feel horrible. She thinks she's harming her baby. Even though the people who are saying this are far less educated than her obstetrician and don't know what they're talking about. But, no, they definitely internalize it. It's hard not to.
Oh, I can imagine that it's hard not to. Yeah, but it just seems to be so, there's just so much of this stuff. And then to go back to the physiological, there's some changes that are going on. I mean, you hear about mommy brain or momnesia, or, I mean, there were some studies that I looked at that shows that because of all the extra blood flow, the brain is actually getting smaller, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. But
well,
there's that as well.
It's not true. In fact, a couple of years ago, I was asked to write an article about mommy brain or pregnancy brain. And in fact, what the research shows in the first two trimesters, there are no cognitive differences in women who are pregnant versus women who are not pregnant. In the third trimester, yes, there is a pregnancy brain. In England, they call it porridge brain. But it's probably, I'm guessing, a lot from fatigue. And if you have not been sleeping well for 5-6 months, your brain is just not going to function the way it should.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. So what are some of the other biggest issues that are facing women who are pregnant, the kinds of things that they wish they could just scream and say, get out of my face and leave me alone?
I think they wish people would stop being so intrusive. I think that's probably one of the top three complaints I hear from patients is they're sick of people giving their opinion when it's not solicited. They're sick of being touched. I think they also want people to be more compassionate about how they're feeling. And a lot of people say to a pregnant woman, I don't want to hear you complain. You wanted this. Especially my patients who went through infertility. I think they often have the toughest time because in here they went through all sorts of things to get pregnant, and then they're really uncomfortable physically or psychologically. And if they complain to anybody, especially their partner, I say, are you kidding me? You know, we went through years for you to get pregnant. We spent all this money, and you should be happy and appreciative. And so they come to me, and I say, you just have 45 minutes. Feel free to complain as much as you want because it's hard. Being pregnant is really hard.
Talking with Alice Domar, who's the author of Finding Calm for the Expected Mom, Tools for Reducing Stress, Anxiety, and Mood Swings During Your Pregnancy. She's actually co-authored with Sheila Curry's Oaks. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking to Alice. I'm Armin Brott, and you are listening to Positive Parenting.
Hands can do incredible things. This is the sound of two hands helping to save a life. It's called hands-only CPR, and it's recommended by the American Heart Association. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. Hands can do incredible things, but nothing compares to using them to help save a life. For more information on this latest method of CPR, visit handsonlycpr.org today. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, talking with Alice Domar, who is the author of Finding Calm for the Expectant Mom, Tools for Reducing Stress, Anxiety, and Mood Swings During Your Pregnancy. So we've talked about all these things that are kind of conspiring to create a miserable expectant mother. What do you tell them about what you can do? Just well, generally speaking, and then we'll get into some of the specifics about, you know, hair dye and wine.
Well, you know, I'm a psychologist, and I teach cognitive behavior therapy. So basically, I want to know what's bothering them. Is it physical or psychological? See if we can identify triggers in terms of what's making the symptom worse. And then, I mean, literally half the book is suggestions on how to feel healthier, both physically and psychologically.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those. So what do you do? What do you do physically?
Well, one of the top complaints, also say nausea. I certainly went through it myself. It can be miserable. And it sounds very common sense, but most women don't do this, is really clearly identify what the triggers for nausea are. And for a lot of women, it's when their stomach is empty and then they eat something. And so my advice is don't let your stomach get empty. Like, I just told a patient this the other day. I said, have food everywhere. Have it by your bed. Have it all over your house. Have it in your car, in your purse, and on your desk. And so you can have, you know, a granola bar or whatever every couple of hours. Your stomach never gets empty. So identify, is it the smell of coffee? Is it the smell of meat? Is it, you know, fish? Whatever it is, identify what your nausea triggers are and do everything you can to avoid them. A lot of people say that. But conversely, you can visualize what appeals to you. And for some women, it may be potato chips. You know, for a lot of women, it can be mint. or citrusy, like lemon tarts. So don't just avoid the things that make you nauseous, but actively seek out the foods and beverages that actually seem okay. And that can help a lot.
All right, speaking of beverages, there's this thing that comes up every once in a while. Actually, well, every time the word wine or alcohol shows up, there gets to be two immediate camps. One says never, ever, absolutely not. And then the other side, and that staff, the other side happens to be staffed with a lot of OBs, says, you know, if you need a glass of wine or it would help you, take it. But it's almost a political thing because, you know, there's nobody can pinpoint the exact time when fetal alcohol
right.
syndrome becomes an issue.
Right, or the exact amount.
Right, so what do you suggest? I mean, it seems like even if you suggest that it might be okay, that you're opening yourself up to some lawsuit later on.
You know, I would hate to be, you know, be in that position, because you're right, if the baby gets the hiccups, they're going to get sued. I mean, what I tell my patients is, listen to your OB, and if your OB says no alcohol whatsoever, it's just a sacrifice you're going to make. You know, I'm a huge believer in living a regret-free life. And before you do anything, especially while you're pregnant, you need to stop and say, if I do this and something bad happens in the future, am I going to regret having done this? So if I have a glass of wine because I'm feeling really anxious and stressed, and then it turns out my child has a learning disability, am I going to think, oh, my God, I shouldn't have had that glass of wine? Now, is that glass of wine going to cause a learning disability? Almost certainly not. But because you can't do a study where you take 1,000 women and have, you know, 100 of them drink this amount and 100 of them drink this more, you're never going to know what the threshold is. And so to be on the safe side, most OBs will say, you know, try to just not drink any alcohol. Or, yes, you can, you know, drink the champagne toast at a wedding. But there's, we don't, it's a total gray area. We have no idea. And I don't want someone to beat themselves up. And I got to tell you, I'm the one that sees these people who beat themselves up. Don't do anything that has the capacity to make you later regret it. Only 9 months. If you feel you need a glass of wine because you're really anxious or stressed, there's so many other things that you can do to counter that anxiety or stress, which don't have the potential to cause side effects.
Okay, so what are those?
Honestly, exercise is number 1 through 10. It is the best stress reliever we know. It certainly decreases anxiety, depression, stress levels. You know, obstetricians, for the most part, want their patients to exercise. You know, things like walking. I'm not talking about, you know, bungee jumping. But exercise is one of the best things you can do for your physical and mental health. Cognitive behavior therapy. That's what I do. It's where you help the woman challenge automatic negative thought patterns. Extremely effective. Relieves anxiety, relieves depression, no side effects. Relaxation techniques. If someone's having a bad day, as opposed to reaching for the glass of wine, you can sit down and just do some breathing techniques or meditation or yoga. Those last, there's no downside.
Okay, and are you concerned about, you know, because there's going to be the pressure, of course, you shouldn't be doing that because you might fall down, and if you fall down, you're going to cause a miscarriage. So it just seems like in some ways that could just be a yet another thing that could drag somebody down the rabbit hole.
You know, I think people have to make a choice. And what I tell pregnant women is, when you're having a good day, write down all the things that you know can help you feel better. And then when you're having these anxious moments, pick one. And it might be, you know, calling a friend. It might be, as I said, going for a walk. It might be watching a really funny movie. I mean, when I'm in a really bad mood, Pretty Woman always perks me up. There are lots of things that you can do, and you don't have to go down that rabbit hole. You can, you know, by the time someone gets pregnant, they have had a couple decades to learn what helps them feel better when they're having a bad time. And that's just a matter of doing them.
Now, what about at work? There seems to be a lot of research coming out now that talks about women who work all the way until the very minute that their baby is born have got they're more likely to have premature births, and there are all sorts of other issues that come up, as opposed to women who are able to take off some time before the baby shows up. However, if they leave too soon, you know, we don't have a particularly good pregnancy leave policy around here. You know, you're going to have people who are going to be stressed out about money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it's funny because I think that, you know, we talk a lot about maternity leave and taking 3 months off after the baby's born and everything else. And I have a lot of patients who could have really used some time off during the first trimester when they're feeling so tired and nauseous they can't move, or during the third trimester when they're just really uncomfortable and have porridge brain. You know, in this country, we don't have generous medical leave. Most companies don't give sort of pre-baby time off. You know, hopefully you have a boss who's understanding. This whole issue of pregnancy, you know, when do you tell your boss? How do you tell your boss? You know, what if you don't want to come back after maternity leave? These are actually, we have a whole chapter on work in the book in terms of how to talk to your boss about your pregnancy. How do you reduce stress during pregnancy? You know, what can you do to balance the demands of your body versus the demands of your job?
So you have a time where dads are much more involved in things than they used to be, and they very much want to be involved in the pregnancy and everything that's going on. So what can guys do to help with this stuff besides just be aware of it? I mean, just that is something by itself. But, you know, can they encourage her to get up and go for a walk, put a little bit of pressure on maybe if she's feeling sluggish, but you know that she really could use that exercise and the stress reduction that comes with it?
I'd say if a man, pregnant woman is feeling down and he suggests that she could use some exercise, he's taking his life into his hands. So I think, you know, when she's in a funk, she probably doesn't want to hear it. But he could say something like, hey, I really feel like going to walk. I love your company. Why don't you join me? That's going to be a very different way of couching it, and it might get her up and going. It's very tough because when she's feeling miserable, she's also feeling irritable. And because he's the one that knocked her up, she may not be very friendly towards him at the time. So I think it puts the guy in a precarious position sometimes. My number one advice to men is whatever she's complaining about, believe her. Because you might think you know how she's feeling, but you don't. Because, you know, when she's nauseous 24/7, you might remember how you felt when you had a hangover. But, A, that was your own doing, and it doesn't last very long. You have no idea what it feels like to be nauseous and know it's going to last for 8 more weeks. You know, you may think you know what it feels like to not get a good night's sleep, but you don't know what it feels like to not get a good night's sleep for 9 whole months. So whatever she's complaining about, it's very hard sometimes to be empathic when you haven't experienced it, but you just have to trust her that that's the way she's feeling.
You know, we have about 30 seconds left, but I'm just really curious about this. Do you make the same recommendations for the non-pregnant woman in a same-sex couple?
Oh, absolutely.
Who may not be familiar with the same things because she's never been pregnant either.
If she's never been pregnant, absolutely. And if she has been, and that's the other thing is, you know, I was just at a family event and there were two sisters, one just had a baby, and she has different symptoms than our sister who was saying, you know, suck it up. And I'm like, you know what? If you haven't experienced it, that doesn't mean the person you love isn't feeling lousy or isn't feeling lousier than you felt. And so just because you haven't experienced it doesn't mean the other person is exaggerating. Every pregnancy is different. And for a woman's own pregnancy, my second pregnancy was far, far more difficult than my first. And I thought that I knew what to expect. So trust her, believe her, pamper her, nurture her.
Alice Domar, the author of Finding Calm for the Expectant Mom, Tools for Reducing Stress, Anxiety, and Mood Swings During Your Pregnancy. Thank you very much. Great to have you.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm the only one in school that can tie his own shoes.
Most kids make fun of me because I still believe in the tooth fairy.
A third of the kids in my 8th grade class drink alcohol regularly.
Over 99% of my class has been offered illegal drugs. Half of my college classmates binge drink, abuse drugs, or do both. But the frequent dinners I had with my family have helped make sure I'm not one of them.
Learn more about the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University's Family Day at CasaFamilyDay.org. Dinner makes a difference.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and it's time for a Parents at Play segment. So school is well underway, and hopefully you've loaded up on markers and pencils and protractors and other school supplies, but what if you underestimated how much stuff your child has to lug to school and just realized that she needs a bigger backpack? And what if your printer is getting low on ink and you just about passed out when you saw how much those new cartridges cost? Not to worry. we have got some solutions for you right here. Backpacks and rucksacks from Sydney Page. Sydney Page makes backpacks that are so snazzy that you might be tempted to go back to school yourself just so you can show off. They come in a variety of sizes, so there's definitely something for toddlers, adults, and everyone in between. The quality and materials are good, the patterns are attractive and blissfully free of licensed images from movies and TV shows, they're roomy, and they have plenty of pockets. There's also a nice social consciousness factor here. For every backpack sold, the company donates an exact matching bag to a child in need. They even fill the pack with school supplies. Sydney Page also makes lunchboxes, pencil cases, and a few other stylish accessories. And there's even a series of illustrated children's books that feature the adventures of Sydney Page herself. Prices range from about $40 to $90. They're available at a lot of online retailers and at sydneypage.com. Backpacks and more from Bixby. If you've got a child in pre-K or kindergarten, you'll love these backpacks, which go way, way beyond cute fabric patterns. The elephant backpack actually has a trunk, and the rocket ship and airplane packs have wings. Other styles include monkey, cat, fox, and butterfly. For older kids, there are plenty of patterns, including zombie camo and solid colors. To minimize the chronic pain and long-term damage that overloaded packs can do to a child's back, Bixby follows recommendations from the American Occupational Therapy Association that says that the backpack should rest in the lower back and be no more than 4 inches below the waist. The website has also a nice chart to help you pick the right one. Bixby's are sturdy, they're PVC, BPA, and phthalate-free, and lead-free as well, and have plenty of pockets for your child's ever-growing menagerie of belongings. You can also get matching or complimentary lunch boxes. Like Sydney Page, Bixby has a big heart, so when you buy a backpack, they donate one just like it to a child in need somewhere in the world. Products range from $20 to $60 at retailers everywhere or Bixby.com. The Expression ET2550 EcoTank All-in-One Printer from Epson. Like many of Epson's other printers, this one allows you to print, copy, and scan, and it features built-in wireless so you can print from your computer, phone, or tablet, which means that your kids will be able to print their last-minute assignments without having to get out of bed. For pictures, there's a card slot so you go straight from your camera to the printer without the extra step of having to copy it to your computer first. But what makes the ET2550 really stand out is the EcoTank, which comes loaded with enough ink to print 4,000 black and white pages and 6,500 color pages. For most of us, that's enough for about 2 years. This printer may be a bit more expensive than others with comparable features, but you'll more than make up for the difference in ink savings. Replacement ink, it's about $12.50 for the black and $50 for the full set of four colors, will cover you for another 2 years. But your current printer would need about 20 cartridges to match the ET2550's output, and at $15 to $50 a pop, you can do the math. The printer is under $300, available online, in stores, or at Epson.com. You can get reviews of a lot more products and games and all sorts of wonderful stuff for parents and kids to be doing together at parentsatplay.com. We'll be back next week with another segment for you. Hey, but don't go quite yet, because you know that there's another whole section of positive parenting coming right up.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
This heavyweight bout is about to begin. The challenger wears white trunks with a blue stripe, and the champ is wearing, looks like an examination gown from the doctor's office. And from the back, we can... Ooh, that's not pretty. Champ, what's with the crazy getup?
I've got to take care of my family.
Yeah, so?
Well, when you love your family, you got to go in and get those important medical screenings. A lot of potentially deadly diseases can be treated if you catch them in time.
So you wear the examination gown because...
Because I'm a real man. Real men take care of their families and get those tests. Real men wear gowns.
Okay, champ, good luck. Here we go. The champ's not wasting any time. It's over. This fight is over. Champ, you barely broke a sweat. Any words for your fans out there?
Remember, go to AHRQ.gov for a list of the tests they need to get and when to get them.
What was that web address again?
AHRQ.gov. And remember, real men wear gowns.
Go to AHRQ.gov. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AHRQ, and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hey there, welcome to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. You know, it's natural to dismiss dangers that we can't see, and that's exactly what's happened with respect to many devastating infectious diseases. Over the past few decades, our medical system has made tremendous progress against its former greatest adversaries. And as a result of that, very few of us have ever seen one of those infectious diseases that used to be around. Surprisingly, a new malady has arisen that we're now suffering from, and that's a type of amnesia regarding the calamitous effects of those infectious diseases that have happened throughout human history. For example, smallpox has had a tremendously horrible effect on human history. Way back into the 1500s, prior to the Spanish conquistadors, it was completely unknown. But after it was introduced, the majority of the indigenous populations were wiped out, and that pretty much led to the collapse of the Aztec and Incan empires. Hundreds of thousands of people died from smallpox every year, but today it's been completely wiped out thanks to vaccinations. Unfortunately, though, a lot of people these days are electing to not vaccinate their kids, and that is causing some real problems, including pockets of disease and death. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking about the science behind vaccinations and the myths behind vaccinations as well. This is an absolutely critical show for you to listen to if you've got kids or you know anybody who's got kids. I'm Armin Brott. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Dr. Bill Miller, who is a physician, and he's also the author of The Microcosm Within, Evolution and Extinction in the Hollow Genome. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So I want to talk to you about vaccinations, because this is something that comes up every once in a while. I mean, we have a tendency to think of, I guess, two different things. We think of, okay, we've wiped out smallpox, we've wiped out a whole bunch of stuff, and every time you hear something about a new virus, the Zika virus, for example, was the latest ones, there's talk about let's create a vaccine for that, or HIV. And so I think all of us know potentially what vaccines are all about. And then on the other hand, you hear, I want to harp a little bit on Jenny McCarthy as the perhaps the popular culture voice of this, but there are people who say, oh, let's look out, vaccines are causing all sorts of problems as well. So hopefully you're going to help us filter through all of that stuff and figure out what's really going on. Give us the basic lay of the land.
The most important thing for us to all remember is that vaccination is arguably the single most important accomplishment of mankind in its consistent struggle for survival. Of all of the threats that we face and have faced throughout our entire human narrative, infectious disease is the most commonplace cause of mortality throughout our history. It is only recently that things have begun to change. People didn't have to worry about cancer because mostly you didn't live long enough to get it.
Yeah, people were living to 30 or 40 or something. Yeah,
exactly. So in the last 300 years or so, we've had the benefits of learning a great deal more about vaccination, and nothing else in history has ever done better things for us. But now, because of this success, it's ironic that there has become there's been the supervention of a form of complacency. Most of the terrible diseases that have afflicted us have been more or less put under control. Let me give you a good example. Let's take measles. If people even think about measles now, they tend to regard it as just, oh, this childhood thing, and it's nothing important. But that's only because it's under such terrific control because of vaccination. In another era, prior to a readily available measles vaccine. It was one of the most deadly diseases in all human history. The amount of mortality from measles was unbelievable. Let me give you a couple of examples. In the Middle Ages, during measles epidemics, there would be villages where 80% of the children, and there are very good records on this, 80% of the children would die within the first few months of life because of measles.
Wow.
That's how deadly measles has been. Let's just take very quickly the conquistadors, the Spanish and Portuguese conquistadors. When they came across to this new continent, there was an indigenous population that didn't have the same infectious diseases. So the indigenous tribes, they offered some infectious diseases over to the Europeans, but the Europeans brought a collective immunity to some very consequential diseases, typhus, smallpox, and measles. Measles was just as deadly as smallpox and typhus for the indigenous population, the Native Americans. It killed off 90% of them. It wasn't the swords and the spears and the armor of the horses that is the reason the conquistadors triumphed.
Right. We developed vaccines to deal with that, and they've been incredibly successful in pretty much wiping out things like smallpox and keeping measles way under control.
That's correct.
But
now, because many of the things that have been considered important are rarely seen, there is the tendency to be dismissive and then to get very confused on the basis of social media and rumors, unsubstantiated and, in fact, flatly false rumors, that there are dangers to vaccination which are entirely untrue. Let's go straight to autism.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest ones. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what your listeners are going to be concerned about because that's what they know about. You mentioned Jenny McCarthy. This issue of autism started because there was a report in a very prestigious medical journal in England called The Lancet. This is big-time stuff in England. This is a top-line journal.
Yeah, it's like the journal. It's a JAMA here, basically.
It's the top of the line.
Yeah.
And so there was a report from a respected scientist that appeared to demonstrate a pretty definitive linkage in this article between the MMR vaccine, a particular type of vaccination, and autism. There's only one problem with it. Shockingly, this researcher was proved to have completely committed scientific fraud. All of the data was made up. It was just insane. And the Lancet then retracted that entire article. There has not been any single article, a scientific article, that has been published to date that shows any definitive link between autism and vaccination.
Well, this guy who wrote the article, Wakefield.
That's exactly right. Andrew
Wakefield,
that's right.
He is kind of unrepentant, though, and has continued to push this idea.
Yes, but you can't. I mean, I understand people have biases. I mean, we all do. But you can't just make stuff up in science. That's what peer review is supposed to correct against, and that's our best defense against ignorance and superstition. The fact that someone's crazy has infected. Interestingly, we're talking about infectious disease. The spread of this rumor is an interesting form of infection. Part of it is good people, really well-meaning, entirely sympathetic people who make observations and because of anecdote believe that they ought to generalize it. So in medicine, Armin, it's critical to separate out anecdote from good science. For example, you and I, we live our lives, we make associations all the time, but just because we make an observation doesn't mean that it's reproducible, doesn't really mean that it has any scientific basis. I knew a guy who had a such and such a syndrome, and he ate a stalk of celery, and suddenly he was better. I'm making light, but this is how normal people think about things and make normal associations. The problem is, in science, we have to fight that. We have to actually have reproducibility. We have to have actual data. And one of the things with autism that makes it even more complicated is that the incidence of autism has tended to be rising, and there's a very big debate whether we've simply changed the criteria to significantly expand how we define autism, how we even care about it. You know, when I grew up several thousand years ago, kids were autistic, I'm sure, but we just said they were a little odd. It was just, you know, we're talking about a different period of time.
Well, part of it also was that those kids were institutionalized, and so we didn't see them as much as we do now when they're being mainstreamed and they're not taken off and stuck into a closet someplace.
That's right, and there was no video. There was people lived on farms. You know, we're not very far beyond being a nearly entirely rural nation. It's only several generations, and there's no chance, knowing genetics as I do and things like that, there's no real reason to suspect that autism as a developmental issue should be changing its pattern, particularly in the modern era compared to the past.
Right.
It isn't impossible that such a thing could happen, but there's no actual data to show that that's true. So we have this unusual confluence where the diseases that people feared and knew to be afraid of have now largely disappeared. We don't see them very often, so we tend to dismiss them as being important, and that leads to complacency, and this leads to danger. And I want to talk for a moment about herd immunity and why it's really important to go ahead and be vaccinated. It's not only your personal protection. Let's just take influenza, the flu vaccine. That's going to come out. It's just being shipped to doctors now. It's going to be readily available very quickly. And I was just talking to someone in Chicago about vaccination, and she was saying she wasn't too sure she was going to have it done. And she said, why should I have a flu vaccine? And I said that there are three good reasons to do it. First is that your personal risk of getting the flu, if you are vaccinated, is tremendously reduced. Your risk of even getting the flu at all is dropped by, it depends on the season, it depends on the exact formulation of the vaccine and how it matches the type of infection that we have this particular year. But in general, that protection is at the 65 to 70% level. So that's already a terrific percentage drop in the chance of you're getting the flu, and we've all had the flu.
Yeah. I'm talking with Bill Miller, who is a physician and also the author of The Microcosm Within, Evolution and Extinction in the Hollow Genome. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Bill and pick up on the rest of the flu incidents going down and the other factors about why you should be getting vaccine, for at least for the flu, and we'll talk about more too. I'm Armin Brandt. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brandt. If you're just joining us, talking with Bill Miller, who's a physician and author, and his book is called The Microcosm Within, Evolution and the Extinction in the Hollow Genome. So you were just talking about the three reasons that people ought to get the flu vaccine, one of them being that your chance of the flu is going to be going down, which is a good thing.
Right.
And you were going to be tying this into herd immunity. And I'll tell you, one of the things that when I have talked to other parents about, you know, who have been doubtful about whether to get a vaccine or not, I guess I take kind of a harsh tone with this, is that, yeah, you don't want to get a vaccine for your kids, that's okay, but keep in mind that that they may be saved, their lives may be saved by the fact that my kids have been vaccinated, and they are not going to pass on any sort of disease to your kids.
Absolutely. You just made the most important point. So we talked about your personal protection. If you do get the flu and you've had the flu vaccine, it is true that the intensity of the flu that you get appears to be attenuated. It's less. You'll suffer less than you did if the immunity that you achieved was not absolute. And now the third and perhaps the most consequential part is this issue of the herd immunity, this protection that we confer towards each other by being immunized. It is absolutely true that vaccination carries very tiny risks. The risks are so small that in your decision tree about whether or not to be vaccinated, the decision is absolutely that you should be vaccinated compared to the risk. There are a few people that can't be vaccinated, however. They may have particularly impaired immune systems that prevent them from being vaccinated with the types of vaccines that are produced. Or there are very rare circumstances in the manner in which the vaccine is manufactured may include products, stabilizers, and different things that people have specific unusual allergies to. So there's a tiny percentage of the population that can't have it done. For example, a child undergoing chemotherapy for brain cancer is not going to get a vaccination at certain points during that therapy.
Right, right.
So if you are vaccinated, what and the rest of the community, a significant percentage of the population is vaccinated, and we're talking about 80% or more to achieve what's termed herd immunity. It means that when enough of the population is vaccinated, the incidence of influenza or some other infectious disease, whichever one we're talking about, is diminished, conspicuously diminished across the entire population because of those people who voluntarily got vaccinated. This is the only means that some of these vulnerable people have to be protected. It is a public service that you do. When you get yourself vaccinated and your children vaccinated, you've done a terrific thing for yourself, and you've also performed a very vital social service.
So just to step back for just a second, you're talking about very tiny risks, and I think that part of what confuses people is, you know, we have a country, 4 million babies are born a year, and so even out of a population that's that big, 4 million, and then we've got hundreds of millions of just general Americans, there's going to be some people who are going to get something or have a bad reaction to something right?
Yes. It is never possible. You know, I've learned in medicine, it is never possible to say anything is riskless. Let's not forget, when you're dealing with tens of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people being vaccinated, at the time of vaccination, for some small percentage of those people, they're going to get sick for other reasons. And the first thing that we're going to do is take that anecdote and suggest that the overlap, the temporal overlap, the time overlap of the vaccination and this person's other problem, there's got to be a relationship. Well, the fact is that there could be one, and it has to always be vigorously investigated. People's minds have to be open to that possibility. But most of the time, it's something else that went on, and the two incidences happened to overlap. That's anecdote. And so this is the problem that we face when you're dealing with public health, and the numbers and the scale and the scope of it is as great as what we're talking about today. It's really easy for even very, very determined and smart people to get confused. And the problem that we face right now is that the Internet is a wonderful thing, but it's also it can also function as the village gossip. You know, I think people have read books or seen movies where there's that one person that goes around the village, a tiny village, and spreads malicious rumors mm-hmm. about other good people and
right.
how destructive that can be. Well, the Internet is a force for a terrific advantage and good, but on the margin, it also gives an opportunity for people to say crazy stuff
yeah.
and to get really wide circulation.
You know, one of the things I think that people could be taking a look at, I think if they're still skeptical about this, is the hot spots, I guess you would call them, that pop up every once in a while where a community or a small group of people living in a particular neighborhood or a religious organization will all decide that they're not going to get their kids vaccinated. And what happens, I've read a number of these cases, some of them have happened in California and some in other places, where all of a sudden you'll have a whole bunch of kids who have whooping cough, where there's no reason for them to have that, and some
exactly.
of them die. And that's the biggest thing, is that every year kids die because their parents have decided they just don't want to do it.
Absolutely. Whooping cough is a very good example because it's a deadly disease. Whooping cough was a source of significant morbidity and mortality. You can cough so hard with whooping cough as an adult or a child, or you break blood, you break ribs, or you burst blood vessels in your eyeball. I'm not making this stuff up. This is a critically serious disease, and people tend to get complacent that it's just like words from the past. You know, in the 1930s, they whooping cough. No, we have whooping cough today, and at a certain rate. Some small dozen or so will die every year because of it. It could be prevented. One other interesting facet in talking about the association between diseases and other things. We all tend to misunderstand random. There's a tendency for all of us to assume randomness means evenness. So, for example, we'd say, well, there's a cluster of leukemia in XX town in New Jersey, and everybody immediately rushes to think it's the water. Well, of course, a good scientist would say, well, let's look at that. Let's be careful that that's not the case. But the biggest thing that happens is sometimes things just do cluster. Sometimes they just aggregate together, and randomly things can occur in multiples, even though it stays just absolutely random. And it's a tough concept, even for many scientists, to accommodate that difference between what it means to have random variation and the problem with things kind of glopping together from time to time.
Well, I think I heard some scientists explain this to me once. If you look at something and the data is absolutely perfectly adjusted and it's perfectly laid out so that it's completely consistent throughout the entire population, that's in many ways a sign that something's wrong.
That's been skewed.
Yeah.
Well, you can. Well, the thing, and we can't go into it, but there's things called curve fitting where you adjust your sample size. You do all sorts of things to make the curves look right. And that's one of the things you have to be very careful about. That's why the concept of peer review, where you have people with competing ideas judging and looking something over, is an important part of the process. It keeps it honest.
Okay, so talk just for a minute. We only have a couple minutes left, but quickly about the vaccine for HPV. What do you think about that? That's another one that's getting a lot of controversy these days.
It's a huge advance. Again, this is an opportunity to prevent very significant long-term outcomes, especially in cervical cancer incidences going forward. It is certainly something that I would encourage everyone to consider having. Every woman having, and it.
Well, boys as well.
Well, yes, because it could be transmitted through same-sex relationships and of course, through heterosexual relationships, too.
So you're encouraging, so that the people are finding basically the same kinds of problems with the HPV vaccine. They're saying, oh, my child was vaccinated and came down with something, and there is a little bit of a movement against that now.
Well, in all steps forward, you have some counter motion against it. That's our human nature, and it will always be so. I don't know of anything that has ever had in medicine that has had a smooth introduction. We don't have much time, but I will say that the introduction of the actual current modern format of vaccination took centuries to accomplish, spreading, coming into favor and then disfavor, and finally with Edward Jenner in England in the 1700s, mm-hmm. Proving that the importance of vaccination at that time. But it was fought bitterly, and people were insistent that it was a horror. And so I'm not surprised that there are people pushing back against it and making associations based on anecdote. That's our human nature, and it will always be so.
You know, Bill, very last question, really quickly. Difference between live vaccines and dead vaccines?
Well, this is a difficult topic because it matters, and it matters particularly from virus to virus. It does affect the quality of the immunization. One of the problems with vaccination, and there are problems with vaccination, is that the immunity that you get depends upon the specific vaccine, the specific disease that is targeted against, and its method of formulation. For example, certain vaccines, like whooping cough vaccine, is now formulated in a way that doesn't have the same living cells that it did before, and it produces much lower incidence of local reaction, pain at the site of injection, mm-hmm. but also it confers much less lasting immunity than it did in the past. So there's always a trade-off.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it right there. Bill Miller is the author of The Microcosm Within, Evolution and Extinction in the Hollow Genomes, also an expert on vaccinations, and a physician. Thanks again, Bill.
Thank you. I appreciate being on the show.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.